It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, more importantly, about recovery. And it's brought to you by our friends at youthonlyisdirected.org. They got a three-part solution for opioids. It's speak out, opt out, and of course, throw out. When they say speak out, that means talk to your doctors. And opt out means, is there anything else I can do besides take this? And if you do have some sitting around the house, throw them out.
Not flush them, though.
No, because it gets into the water.
Get the fish high.
Yeah, then you sometimes you drink the water.
It's horrible for the environment. What do you do? How do you throw it out?
Well, they've got drop boxes that you can go around, and you can go to useonlyisdirected.org to find out those drop boxes. They do events that everybody can bring them down.
Right.
And also you can put them in a dirty diaper or coffee grounds.
That's what they say.
Uh-huh.
I don't have dirty diapers.
What about coffee
around.
Grounds?
Yeah, we got those.
Yeah, you just want to make them not appealing for people who are going through your trash.
Okay. I hope no one's going through my trash.
So before we got on, we were talking about some of our favorite TV shows and somehow ended up on Melrose Place. Remember Melrose Place?
I remember it, but I never watched it. I never watched it.
All through college, we'd have nights where people would come over and watch Melrose Place.
Did you go to an all-girls college?
No, I went to Utah State.
Oh, okay.
I was in a fraternity, and it was a lot of fun. We'd have Melrose Night.
So your sorority would get together
my fraternity,
and watch Melrose Place.
And 90210. But this reminds me of the time when
I know 210.
I loved it.
Did you?
And Dylan McKay.
Really?
Rest his soul. He passed on.
No, that's true. I never watched that either.
He had a cool eyebrow where it had just one line down here, like where he either got stitches or something, but there was a line in his eyebrow.
Oh, yeah?
And I saw that, and I was like, I want that.
So did you get some stitches?
No. So I got a razor, and I thought I was going to cut just this line in my eyebrow.
Yeah.
Ended up cutting off the half of my eyebrow. And people were like, what happened? I was like, I want to look like Dylan McKay.
Well.
Yeah. 90210.
Yeah, that 30-year-old guy that was in high school.
Yeah. Hey, so hold on. I want to do something. Let's see if I can do this.
I actually think Dylan was our age.
Yeah, he was about that.
Yeah, he was way too old for a high school show.
Hey, Suri, how many days till September 13th?
It's 80 days until then.
80 days left for me blowing.
All right.
Yeah, then I don't have to go down to the...
So it's 160
blows. 160
blows
away.
It's twice a day, right?
But I was walking in there this morning to blow, because I do it twice a day, between 6:30 and 8:30 in the morning and 6:30 and 8:30 at night. Every day, including holidays, Christmas, New Year's, I was there. And this lady who was coming in after me, she goes, why are you so happy all the time? And I was kind of taken back by it. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, every time I see you, you're smiling and you're happy. And I know what you're doing because I'm doing the exact same thing. And I just can't find myself being happy.
Oh, interesting.
And then I started thinking about it on the drive. And I get that a lot in my life. Why are you so happy?
Yeah.
And I think the reason I am so happy is because the opposite is being so mad. And I don't want to
be. The opposite's not good.
Yeah, I don't want to be mad. So when I see a situation, I want to think of the good things that are there and not focus on the bad. And I think we all have those choices. And I'm not naive to say that I don't have bad days, because I have bad days like everybody else. But I do try to focus on the positives. And so I think if we can do that when we're walking around everyday life and just go, try to focus on the positive, because there is so much negative out in the world and it gets easy. And I think it leads you down a dark path. So just try to focus on the happy things if you can.
So it's optimism is what you're talking about, being optimistic.
We talk about optimism, but I think it's also just – it takes a lot of energy to be angry.
I think it takes more energy to be angry and frustrated and down. But a lot of people, especially nowadays, are finding themselves feeling that way. So what you're saying is make a conscious choice – to look for the good and the positive.
Now this is where
is that you told the lady.
Yeah, okay. But this is where you would say something gets thoughts. What is that?
Oh, thoughts, feelings, behaviors.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, right?
No, yeah, that fits a cognitive pattern like that for sure.
So go over that one more time, because I think that's an important.
How we
lesson.
Think about things, mm-hmm. our thoughts and perceptions about our experience every day, has a huge impact on our emotions, how we're feeling, and how we're feeling definitely determines what we end up doing. So you can see how a person who is focused on the problems and the bills they got to pay and all these sorts of things are going to be in a low emotional state and their behaviors are going to be unproductive. But like you said, if they take your advice and kind of wake up in the morning and say, yeah, despite all the problems, I'm going to try to focus on the good things, the positives, the people I meet, the things that go my way today, they're going to be more happy and up in their energy and their behaviors will be productive. So, no, I think that's great psychology. I mean, that's exactly right. I think some people, well, we know from research, some people come to it a little more naturally, being optimistic and positive, but we can all learn to be more that way. In fact, for the listeners, there's a great book called Learned Optimism by Martin Seligman. And I don't recommend a lot of books to people because, frankly, most of them are boring.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a good book. He's a good writer, definitely an expert in the field, Learned Optimism. If you want to learn how to be more optimistic, you can remember that pattern, but you could also get that book.
So it is a learned trait.
It's both. It's both. Actually, genetic studies show that optimism and pessimism, to some degree, is an inherited trait. But it is learned over your lifetime, depending on your experiences. It starts you off somewhere. Your biology might start you off in the middle or more on the optimistic side or pessimistic side. But then the experiences we have shape that on that continuum. So if you had a great life and people are modeling optimism, you're going to end up being more optimistic. If you learn to look for the negative, you're going to be less optimistic.
Well, let's bring in our guest. Mara, would you say you're an optimist, a pessimist, or a realist?
I would say a realist. 100% realist.
Now, Mara is our guest today, and she's coming to us from Fit to Recover, which is a great program that I used in the early stages of my recovery. And we're going to find out more about that in just a little bit. But this is where we like to hear your story, Mara. So walk us through it.
So I guess if I had to start somewhere, would be just the dynamic of my family. I grew up with 8 brothers and 1 sister, and I'm the 2nd oldest, and then I have 1 older sister, and then just 8 boys. So from an early start, I think is where I started to feel like not part of, because my mom didn't want me being a tomboy. She wouldn't let me play the sports that I wanted to play because she just was so worried that I was the only like baby at home that needed to like be girly. And being Mexican, I think the culture shifts a lot of how you think about yourself. Like, I was taught from probably like 3 or 4 years old how to clean, like just to be tidy, just to be looking out for my brothers more so as a caretaker, not so much as a sibling. And I think that made me retract and always feel like, why can't I do that? Like, it looks so fun being outside and playing sports. And just my brother's box, one of them did early on, and I was just like, that's something that I would be so good at, because I was already angry by the time I was 12-13 years old. I was like the constant babysitter because both of my parents had to work to support that many kids, and I didn't understand that, and I didn't understand why I didn't have my time or like my friends, or if I was going to go play with somebody, I had to bring 1 or 2 of my brothers so that the other 2 boys could have 1 or 2. And it just turned into that. And granted, now I'm very grateful because I have a great relationship with them, but in the beginning it wasn't that.
And you had a lot of resentment, it sounds like.
A lot of resentment and a lot of just not understanding. Like, not understanding why, because I'm the girl, I had to wash like 40 dishes and my brothers would be the ones that would use 1 little plate for 1 thing and just be outside playing all of the time. And I just didn't get that. And I just almost started to think like, maybe my mom has it out for me. And I remember thinking that now that I've done a lot of different types of therapies and just getting to know like what's my stuff and what was projected onto me, I think made me understand more. I have this like feeling inside of me all the time that people are like coming at me. Like, if somebody wants to get to know me, I'm like, okay, like, what do they want? Or what are they trying to get to? And not just like they're just asking to just want to know you. And I don't know where I lost that worthiness of that people want to know me for me, not because of who my siblings were or not because of being different. Because I grew up in Syracuse, Utah, and there weren't very many Hispanic families there. There weren't very many colored people. So I always just assume that because that's what my mom would feel or that's what my dad would say. And it just turned into this whole other like belief that was never true, that I was not good enough. And I can remember that from probably being 7 or 8 years old when I had to go to special classes because my siblings didn't speak that much English, even though I did, just to help them. And now
you had
I'm
to go to special classes
like ESL, English as a second language,
To help
even
your
though
siblings?
Well, just because they were there and it would be better to like group us together.
Oh,
you know, and just so that there weren't just
you're
three
like,
or
hey,
four
I'm fine with
three
English,
or four
but
people.
I need to go.
And that's what we didn't understand, because I went to preschool here, like I like just from the beginning of my schooling, like we were separated. And it was more so that my parents would be able to help with the homework. And I didn't understand that. Like, I just thought I was in this resource class because I wasn't smart enough.
So did you feel like you were being segregated, not separated?
I think so. A little bit. But then I also have the other side where once I put that guard down, people were very accepting and very helpful. And a lot of the times they just wanted to know more about my culture or the food. Like, who doesn't like tacos? You know?
I love them.
And I used to take that as like offensive, like just this thing where people just wanted to make me feel bad. And I think I've carried that up until like 4 years ago, that I've gotten to do some more healing with like a sweat lodge and a different type of program than I've ever seen, where I met this lady, Tammy, that she is a very big believer in the Lakota traditions.
I know Tammy.
And she helped me realize, like, hey, and she had to say it in a way that I would hear her. And she was like, no one is coming after you. Like, if you put your guard down, like, you would see how beautiful it is to have a friendship. And so I started to trust that. And I was like, okay, like, I'll pick one person in recovery that I'm going to feel comfortable with and surface. Like, just be like, these are the drugs I did. This is how bad it got. And just leave it at that, and never talking about, like, the emotional aspect or more the mental health stuff that I dealt with. Because I guess I skipped way over, but so when I was, I want to say maybe 7, almost 8 years old, my parents got in trouble for drugs and I had to go to the state's custody for the first time. And I was there for almost 8 months. And my sister was older, so she went to a troubled youth home or whatever those are called. And then my little brothers, all because they were younger and small, like they got placed instantly. So it was her at one group home, me at a different one. And even at 8 years old, I just was rebellious, and I would fight the people that I got house with. And I don't think I stayed at one house. I was only in there the first time for maybe 8 months. And I think they moved me around 4 or 5 times just because of
for a kid that age, though,
just because of my behavior. And so they would move me from one place to another. By the time I thought, like, oh, maybe I'll make friends, like, I just shut that part down. Like, I just didn't need to have friends. And so I decided to dive into basketball and just always have a ball with me. And no matter where you go, like, if you know how to play, like, people are your friends. And you don't have to really conversate because you're playing. And so I learned that early on, that if I could just be doing something to find that connection, it wasn't that hard. But then I got back with my family, and we were living in Salt Lake at this point, and my mom, I think, was really nervous or scared. I've never asked her, so I guess this is just me assuming, but she sent all of my siblings to Mexico to live with one of my aunts there. And it was just me and my oldest brother, Eddie, that were here. And that's where I started to build this like codependent thing where, like, if he was doing something, I wanted to do it. Or if, like, he wasn't, I wouldn't either, just so that we could stay together. And we did a lot of stuff together, and he just excelled in academics, and he just was so good at it. And he would have every teacher that I did, and I would have to go with my mom to these parent-teacher conferences and kind of translate for her. She understood a lot of it, but there were just certain things that she would want me to say. And sometimes I think the way that teachers would say things, it would make me, like, feel dumb. Like, they'd be like, oh, we didn't even know this was, like, her brother because he's doing so well. And it's just, like, in that sense, when I had them was when things were going really bad in my family. I just wanted to make sure I was okay, like, that I had food or that I could figure out where I was going to stay, like, if I was going to stay in one placement. But when we went back, things shifted with my mom and dad. He started his own landscaping business. My mom was working at an old folks' home for a while. And then I think my brother stayed in Mexico for 3 years and then came back. And at this point, we lived in Syracuse, Utah. And things were, like, normal. We joined the church. the LDS church, and I started doing that, and that felt fine. Like, and it was just something.
How old were you at that time?
I was just going into seventh grade, so 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to be part of, and I started doing that route and like going to girls' camp and all of that stuff, but it didn't feel like me. Like, I had no idea why I was doing these things, but I just wanted my mom to be happy, and I thought if I could just do my part, my family would stay together. But my house burnt down when I was in the eighth grade, and we had to move. And in that move, I had just had a quinceañera, so I was 15 and thought I was in love, and that I like knew this boy, and that we were just going to be married forever. And I got pregnant. I got pregnant after being sexually active twice. And that I was a young teen mom, and my culture is very against like abortion or even talking about that or adoption. And it just turned into this. No one was ever like, hey, like, are you OK? It turned into, we're going to be OK. We're going to raise this baby. Like, this is what's going to be done. And I was young. I didn't know. And I was like, OK, yeah, whatever. And that's when I started to drink and do drugs. And
so you felt like nobody really asked how your experience with
no one ever really asked like what I thought.
How did you feel?
I didn't know. I was like, I remember thinking back because I was freaked out. I remember being scared, and I remember being ashamed because the only people that did ask me anything about it were people from my ward that wanted to adopt my daughter. And so that was weird because my parents never talked about that part. Like, no one ever was like, hey, look, you could have this option.
Okay.
And like,
did you feel
no one,
it wasn't an option?
No.
Because of your
family
felt
like it
culture,
wasn't because of how like they were already buying all of the baby things and how they were already like talking as like a we. And I found out I was having a girl. And so everybody was so excited about that because it was just eight boys after me. And somewhere in between there, or I don't know if the whole time, my parents continued to sell drugs and do drugs. They're both addicts. And by the time I was 17, I moved out of my house because I didn't get along with my dad. Like, we just
And you were
fought.
Raising your daughter.
Trying to.
The best at 15, 17 year old can do.
Yeah.
I was trying to because I didn't have that, like, motherly instinct. And my mom wasn't a very big hugger or even really talking about anything. Like, it was just like, oh, something's wrong. Like, suck it up, cry in your room. And, like, we portrayed this, like, great family at church. And, like, when things, like, finally, when they had gotten arrested again, I think we covered up one or two of the times where they were arrested, and, like, no one knew. Like, we just figured out how to parent ourselves, and it took...
So your parents were off in jail, but
it
you guys
took
were home
like,
running out.
I want to say from... like 2004 and 2007 for the state to actually catch on, like, hey, these kids are by themselves.
Wow.
Like, it, like, whoa. Actually, like, notice, you wow. know? And maybe it was a lot of us, like, covering, and a lot of the times, like, we just weren't there if they ever showed up, or if they did, we didn't ever open the door. Like, that's just what we were taught. And then one of my aunts ended up coming to live with us from Mexico, and she had this very different approach than my mom, and she just was always pissed off, like always angry. And I remember thinking, like, in my mind, I was like, it's because she got married when she was young. And I was like, that's never going to be me. And I don't know why that was what I thought. Like, I'm like, she didn't get to have a life, like, because she was a young mom too.
And it seems like that was your experience. I mean, you were saying from age three or four, you were learning to take care of siblings.
Yeah.
And
probably before that, that's just when I remember.
Yeah,
like, that's just the earliest memories that I have.
Sort of robbed of those typical childhood freedom to just explore, it sounds like.
You're listening to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, more importantly about recovery. We're listening to Mara's story. We'll be back in just a few seconds.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
So your aunt comes from Mexico, and she's staying with you guys, and she seems to be mad all the time.
Did she come just to take care of you guys?
Because, yes, and yeah. Also she did like house cleaning and stuff, so she would come here 2 or 3 months out of the year and save her money and then go and like build up her house or whatever she had to do in
Mexico. Was she always angry when she came or just this time you're talking
about? All of the time that I could think of.
Kind of her style, huh?
I can think of most of the women in my family just had this anger. And I always thought it was because they didn't want to be cooking and cleaning all of the time for that many people. And so I rebelled against that. And I was, because that's what I hated, you know? And so I was like, well, if I just don't have a boyfriend, if I just don't get married, if I just don't have to cook and clean all of the time, like maybe things will like lighten up. And I just started partying all the time and drinking.
Do you remember when you first had a drink or did drugs?
Yeah. I was 12 years old, and I think it was my sister's 29th birthday, and they thought it would be funny to let me have a wine cooler, like, as a joke. And it was all kinds of adults around, and everybody just thought it was, like, this joke. And I remember going outside, laying down, and just seeing this tree, like, spinning and thinking, like, oh, my God, I can't wait to do that again. Like, I finally stopped
instead
that.
Instead of it being a negative.
Yeah,
it was a
I remember thinking, yeah. Like, I didn't feel self-conscious. I didn't feel worthless, and I didn't have all this chatter in my mind.
Isn't it interesting? Because on this podcast, we often talk about someone's first taste of alcohol or first time doing drugs. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar that most people have that kind of experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very, you know, mind changing, body changing.
Anybody can develop a problem with drugs and alcohol, but many people who have a lifelong struggle with it, they're kind of predisposed. And so the first time, they're kind of like, oh, that's my jam. You feel different. Whereas a lot of 12-year-olds who drink a wine cooler and lay on the grass feel like, oh, this is scary. I don't want to.
This is horrible. It's horrible. Yeah.
Well, and then you come from a household where it's like yelling and fighting. But when people are drinking, like everyone's happy. And like, well, and maybe for like the first part of the night. Like people are happy. People are dancing. People are like, hey, let's go buy this. Hey, let's go do this. And so, and that's what I think I assumed from the beginning. And I jumped from having that wine cooler to finding cocaine at my own house. And I was like, oh, let me see what this does. And then I took more of a route like, well, we don't have that much money. What if I take a little bit more from my dad here and there and they don't notice? And I started selling drugs in early high school, maybe 9th grade.
Wow.
And realizing, like, hey, I'm really good at this. Like, I'm really good with people, and I have really good drugs, and people like that. And I felt like people liked me without having to give any part of me.
So, again, it gave you a sense of importance.
And just not having to share anything. Mm-hmm. You know how when you have those people that don't want to talk to you, you don't want to be around them. But because I had drugs, I didn't have to say anything. I would just be like, oh, like, you want to know me?
I imagine I imagine there's not a lot of heart-to-heart conversations going on with a drug dealer.
Probably not.
I remember when we had Andy, the comedian.
Yeah, yeah. Andy Gold.
Andy Gold on. And he said his drug use got so bad that his drug dealer called and says, are you okay? He goes,
that's bad.
Yeah, that's bad when the drug dealer's like, I don't think you should be taking this much. But I can understand what you're saying is that you were there for a reason, a purpose. You didn't have to give any of yourself, but you felt needed and you felt important.
And I remember the times that I did try to, like, be like, hey, something's going on at my house that doesn't feel right. And because of like how my parents were, nobody ever believed that because I was already fighting in school. I was already ditching class, smoking pot, dealing drugs, and just people always assumed that I wasn't telling the truth. And so I was like, you know what? Well, if you're not going to believe me, like I'm just shut down. From the age of 14, 15 years old, I never wanted to talk about me. I never wanted to tell anybody what was wrong. And now the work that I've done, I realized that I lived my life out of trauma and like having so much PTSD where if even somebody stood behind me, like I didn't feel right. Mm. Or if I saw like a cop car because we were raided so many times, I instantly would clam up even though I wasn't doing anything.
Do you remember during those high school years, were there any people that tried to get close to you in sort of a mentoring way, like a teacher or
I do remember two teachers. So I went to Canyon Heights in Kaysville. And I had an English teacher named Chris, and she gave me the book, is it A Million Little Pieces or something, about the guy does the drugs or whatever. And I was 17, and I remember reading it through one night, and I never went back to her class. I was like, she knows I'm on drugs. I was like, she knows I'm on drugs. I'm never going back there.
So why didn't you go back?
And
you,
because I just assumed that they were going to like lock me up. My parents were already
her, why did she give you that
locked
book,
up? So funny, I ended up reaching out to her maybe like 5 years ago and just letting her know, hey, remember when you had those people come in and say, if you don't do all of these things before you leave high school, you're never going to get to them. Like any type of classes or tech classes that you wanted to take, they're like, this is when. And I remember just singing, this is like, they just don't want to have to spend time with us. So they want to send us over to the DATC. And I just didn't believe in people. And when I emailed her, she's like, I knew from the beginning, she's like, you were going to have an uphill battle. And I wish that you would have listened.
So she was trying to be helpful.
And that's what she told me. And I had a lot of teachers there that I remember just asking questions or just wanting to help. They had so many different types of programs, like for diapers or if you needed formula for your baby, and even a daycare there where they would teach you like how to raise your baby, how to connect. And I just wasn't open to it then.
But you said at an early age, you felt like every time somebody came to you, they wanted something from you.
Right.
So you were always defensive. And so when somebody would give you a book, you thought, oh, they want something or they're going to bust
me. Or she just knew. She knows I'm a meth because all of that book talked about crack and meth. And I would just assume like she knew and like she just wanted me.
So in high school, you were selling drugs, ditching class, starting fights. Did you end up graduating high school?
Yes, but not when I was supposed to. I had to go back and do like a super senior type of thing and do packets. So yes, I did, but not in the right timing. And so that I just gave up.
And you had your baby this whole time, right?
No. So I had my baby up until she was 1.5. And then right when I was supposed to graduate 2007, my parents ended up getting arrested like for the final time. And they had a lot of different charges and they were doing fed time. So they both went away for 10 years.
Oh.
And by that time, I was 17 thinking, if I can get it together, the state will let me keep some of them. But that was not the case. And that wasn't the case because, like, by that point, we had a huge file. Like, I had one brother that almost ran and no one was around. I had two brothers that needed to get stitches here and there, and my parents weren't there. Two of my brothers... Two different brothers had to get their stomachs pumped while being in state's custody. And I just always had that fear because I was their safe person and I was who they called, that I was the one that was going to get arrested. And when I saw them and I knew, like, we have to do something, I knew to call their foster parents. And luckily they were so nice and open and just caring. That was one of the first times I remember. It was my two oldest brothers. One was 16 and the other one was 15 when they went into the state's custody, so they weren't going to adopt them, but they let them stay in the same house. And then the other six brothers, three got adopted to one family, two got adopted to a different one, and then one got adopted to a family friend that we grew up with. So luckily, it's so weird how that happened too, because the family that adopted the three adopted one of my brothers that was 6 months. I think my brother Ramito was around 10, maybe 12 at the most. And then my brother Ramon was 14. And so at least they got to stay together. And I went to school with their girls. So like they knew my family. We were in the same ward together. And they had no idea that that was what family it was until we had a sibling day or whatever they would call it, where they would let us all get together. And our caseworker was so great that she made sure that the families knew that we needed each other, because I grew up here with no aunts or uncles really, other than when they would come and visit for a month or two. I never really knew my grandparents. They passed when I was younger on both sides, my mom and dad's. And it really was just me and my siblings growing up mostly. I had a cousin here or there that would move here and then go back, but we didn't really have that family dynamic other than ourselves. So I see now that that was such a codependent, crazy thing, because if one of us was out doing something or partying, the other ones would want to be like, oh, hey, like, let me come with you.
So and just to get everybody up to speed, both your parents get sent away for 10 years.
Yes.
State comes in and takes your eight brothers and divides them up to three different homes.
Four.
Four different homes.
Four different homes.
And where does that leave you?
Just by myself. because so they got arrested in December and I had turned 18 on the 9th. So by the time that they actually like had a court case against them and it got brought to them in front of a judge, I was already 18. So there wasn't anything they could do for me.
And where was your baby?
She was with my sister. So I think my mom kind of had a feeling that something was going to happen. And she went down, her birthday is the 5th of December. And so she went down the beginning of December to spend time with my sister and left my daughter down there.
In Mexico.
And no, they lived in St. George.
Oh, St. George.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I forgot about that. Yeah, my sister had moved.
But not that far south.
Yeah. Right. So she was living in St. George, okay. Took my daughter down there. And by the time that my sister realized, like, hey, they're going to be in there a really long time, I was a full-blown meth addict. And there was no way that I was going to care for her. Like, I didn't know how. I didn't want to. And my sister really loved her so much that she was like, well, I'll keep her.
Hmm. Okay.
And so she had her. And then 2 or 3 years later, I was like doing better, not like the best, but I had stopped doing meth and was trying to go to meetings, but I didn't really know what that meant. And I would just go so that in my mind, I still thought there was something I could do for the two oldest and that maybe if they saw that I had my own place and that I had my shit together, that they would let them come stay with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that never happened. Because then I ended up on drug court and a lot of other stuff that I don't know. I can't remember right now. Oh, my brothers ended up joining the football team up. They went to Tremonton and they were both doing so well and like getting into sports. And I would see when we visited, they were almost like embarrassed to like talk about how well they were doing.
Oh.
And it was kind of like this whole shame that I think has not torn me and my siblings apart. But like if we're in trouble, I think that's not who you think of first, you know, like we don't have that bond where a couple of us do. But like the younger ones, I think we're so young that like we're not who they call.
Do you think the shame was explain that? So they were doing really well. They're playing sports, going to school, I assume getting good enough grades to be on the football team.
I think the shame was that it was just me.
They were ashamed of you?
No, like that I was just like left behind or like left apart, I guess.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were?
Not at the beginning. Not until, like Mother's Day, I think it was, like from December to about May.
Mm.
And then just thinking like, where are we going to go?
Because you were responsible for these. I mean, at an early age, you were taught to care for these.
Right. And we do have a strong bond, but it's not, hey, what are you doing today? Or let's talk about our feelings.
Well, what happened to you, we call it being adultified or parentified. You're put in this parental role that you really weren't a parent, but you were taking care of your younger siblings like you were a parent. And so that changes that dynamic from it just being a sibling friendship to now they kind of saw you maybe as kind of something between a mom and an aunt, you know?
Right.
And that can change than the adult relationship as well.
You're listening to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, brought to you by our friends at useonlyasdirected.org. We're listening to Mara's story. Make sure you tune in to episode 2. We're going to find out what her rock bottom looks like and what she's doing now.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.